Greetings and welcome to First Impressions, a production of Marginalia Radio. I'm your host, Dave Kruger. Joining us is Heather R. White, a visiting professor in religion, queer, and gender studies at the University of Puget Sound. Heather is the author of Reforming Sodom, Protestants and the Rise of Gay Rights, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2015. Heather, welcome to Marginalia Radio.
Hi, David. Great to be here.
Conventional wisdom is that conservative religious leaders are the source of today's anti-gay animus in American culture. However, you argue that liberal Protestants share some of the blame. How so?
Great question. And I'll say it's not so much blame or fault, but it's just to revisit the assumptions about what the historical sources of oppression are when it comes to anti-gay ideas. And I think that most people assume that religion is that source, that it's kind of a time capsule for ancient or archaic understandings of gender and sexuality. And then they also assume that conservative religious groups are the ones that are closest to those ancient and archaic perspectives. So the logic goes, yes, conservatives are, we think, to blame for anti-gay animus. And even though it's certainly the case that conservative groups are often are the most active around anti-gay causes, what I look at is where those religious ideas emerged from. So one of the things that I found is that what we think of as a traditional Christianity, and specifically a traditional Protestantism, is actually a really modern invention. And it's been shaped by the therapeutic sciences of the late 19th century. And they have brought in particular assumptions about sexuality. So those anti-gay ideas and those anti-gay readings of the Bible, kind of theological understandings, that all of those have more recent roots than most people realize. And it was actually, so this is to get back to the liberal Protestant question, it's actually liberals who were the vanguard in seeking out the perspectives of the late 19th century therapeutic sciences. It was that group that had a very formative role on what we today think of as traditional Christianity. Those specific anti-gay Bible readings and theological understandings have earlier roots in liberal Protestant ideas that were first formulated and then later taken up by the more conservative wings of Protestantism and other forms of Christianity.
Could you give our listeners a brief history of the concept of homosexuality? When did Protestant Christians first come to imagine it as something in opposition to heterosexuality?
Yeah, another good question and another tricky question, because again, like, this is one that, if to open up the kind of Bible that most Protestants read, or Protestants in America reading an English translation, that if you open that up and look for homosexuality, you find it in the words of the text. So you'd think that this is a word that has ancient roots, that goes back to when the authors of the Bible were writing, but it's actually not the case. That's a word that has been put into the words of the Bible through recent translation projects, and it actually appeared in other sources well before it appeared in the Bible. So to get to the historical question, it's a term that was invented by European physicians and physicians who were investigating mental pathologies and doing this in the late 19th century. So in the early 20th century, Americans, reading in English again, would only have been able to find this in medical textbooks. By the 1930s, they may have found it in a handful of popular sources, but it wasn't until 1946 that this was a word that could be found in the Bible. And that was, to go back to the liberal Protestants, that was the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, which was a liberal Protestant translation project. So it's a word that has only recently become part of the biblical text and taken up in later translation projects.
You describe how gay and lesbian people took advantage of the paradigm of therapeutic orthodoxy to establish a liberation movement. Could you explain?
The second chapter looks at how homosexuality went from a disease diagnosis into an identity category. And what I do in the second chapter really looks at how religion was part of the mix. I think a lot of people aren't aware that there were quite a lot of religious groups, including institutionally affiliated religious groups, that were involved and active in the 1940s in some of the first societies that were organized around gay and lesbian identity. And so part of that is just looking at how those folks who were involved in those organizations, and those include what has been called at the time the homophile organizations, and they have some funky names like the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis. But there were also a number of religious fellowships, including quite a number of churches. And even I look at a kind of under-the-stair counseling service that was operated through I'd say, backdoor support from the Episcopal Church in New York City, or at least from some Episcopal leaders in New York City. So all of this was kind of looking at how people who found themselves, you know, who struggled themselves with their same-sex desires, kind of grappled with the same set of sources that physicians and counselors and clergy were looking at, and read themselves into the category, in a sense, identified with it, and worked to disseminate a body of knowledge to other people like them, so that they were, again, turning that disease diagnosis into an identity category, into something that was about who they were and that connected them with other people.
How did liberal Protestants make the shift from viewing gay and lesbian people as victims of a medical condition to seeing them as victims of political injustice?
A lot of that had to do with the politics of the 1950s and Cold War politics, where homosexuals were explicitly named and targeted as enemies of the state. That played out in a number of different kinds of ways, but it meant that people who were suspected of being sex deviants or homosexuals or could lose their jobs, could be arrested for suspected or suspicious behaviors, could be denied any number of public services or accommodations without anybody questioning that that was the right thing to do. It was part of the kind of surveillance arm of many local policing forces. So I think that that targeting and that surveillance was one that also at points targeted people that were known to some of those liberal Protestant clergy. And they were among the group of liberals who began to fight against those kinds of tactics and politics. So it was really key that the policies of victimization brought them to question some of the ways that homosexuality was stigmatized. In 1967, there were two liberal Protestant publications. One was coming out of the Presbyterian churches, and one was coming out of the United Church of Christ. And they had these kind of social justice magazines that in 1967 published these issues devoted explicitly to homosexuality as a cause of justice for concerned Christians, that concerned Christians needed to advocate for these victimized homosexuals. And homosexuals was definitely the term being used at the time. One of the things I did in my research was to trace back some of where those issues came from. And one of the things that was interesting in the time frame were that there were two things that were, well, at least two things that contributed to those two issues. One was the earlier formation of an organization in San Francisco called the Council on Religion and the Homosexual. And this was an advocacy group that paired homophile organizations with sympathetic clergy and worked to reform San Francisco's police practices and laws that were penalizing perceived sex deviants. So that organization was formed in 1964, and it had a huge influence on getting the clergy involved in thinking about homosexuality as a political issue. But then another thing that was kind of going on behind the scenes, there was a minister, UCC minister named Robert Spike, who had been very active in the National Council of Churches and had been one of the key leaders in getting white Protestant clergy to be active in civil rights organizing. And he had been involved, again, kind of on a number of issues around race and civil rights in the early 1960s, stepped down from that role. And then October 1966, he was found bludgeoned, killed after a visit to an event in Columbus, Ohio. And one of the things that happened in the aftermath of that was the local police did a kind of an effort in uncovering the suspected homosexual liaisons of this clergy. And so it was kind of a controversy that had ripple effects all over these different liberal Protestant leaders who were already kind of worried about what would it mean to be perceived as enemies of the state in the way that homosexuals were. But on the other hand, they were also just grief-stricken over a beloved colleague who'd been so involved in these social justice causes. It was a matter of just a few weeks, actually, after his death, that a group of liberal Protestants held a quiet conference that invited members of homophile organizations to meet with these leading clergy to talk about homosexuality as a political issue and as a justice cause. And those two magazine issues were the direct fruit of that meeting.
The gay liberation movement that grew dramatically starting in the late 1960s is typically characterized as a secular movement. How does your book challenge that view?
Yeah, thank you for that question. the gay liberation movement of the 1960s is kind of a one that most people know about because it was galvanized in the immediate aftermath of the Stonewall riots, when patrons at a gay bar in Greenwich Village in New York responded to police harassment and resisted arrest and began rioting really on the streets of Greenwich Village. And that's a well-known and it's a justifiably well-known event. But a lot of what the focus has been because of that is on the organizing that took place in New York at that particular moment and a particular mostly Marxist and sometimes very vocally anti-religious sector of organizing that was going on in the 1960s. What I look at in the fifth and the final chapter of the book is when we actually start looking for religion, what is it that we find? I kind of wrestled with the question too, I'll say, because on the one hand, I didn't want to discount the Stonewall event and the organizing that took place because of it, clearly very influential. But at the same time, there was all this other organizing and activism going on that seemed to be eclipsed by that particular moment. And one of those was Troy Perry, who's the founder of the Metropolitan Community Church, who started that church in Los Angeles about 8 months before Stonewall. And again, he wasn't the first to start a church. There had been other churches formed before, but the MCC was sort of like Stonewall. It kind of exploded and quickly became a national movement and quickly kind of formed an interconnected structure. And what a lot of people, I think, don't realize is that the MCC by 1977 was the largest national gay grassroots organization in the United States. And it had the kind of staying power and connectional kind of structure that the gay liberation organizations in and of themselves were not able to sustain over time because of different kinds of internal politics around identity. So the MCC managed to continue to grow and managed to continue to stay in that connectional structure. And it also inspired organizing across these different religious organizations. So Dignity, just a few months after the MCC started in Los Angeles, a group of gay Catholics began meeting and also in the greater Los Angeles area. And then within a few years, groups of Protestants also began to organize within their denominational structures. And so if you look capaciously kind of across the board, across the movement, what you see is that there was religious organizing that crossed every major faith group. Catholics, Protestants, Jews, across denominations, across even more conservative groups, evangelicals, Mormons, that actually there was a stunning amount of gay and lesbian identified religious organizing and activist work that started during the 1970s. So this was a real question for me. When you look for religion, there's a lot to see. Why is it that this is not at all part of the story that we hear when we find out about Stonewall or when we find out about 60s and 70s identity activism work? Why is it that religion is often off the map? And what I offer in that chapter is a theory for why that kind of invisibility is almost structured into the way we remember history. And I make the case that religious groups, and particularly the MCC, and perhaps even particularly those Christian groups, were very involved in the commemoration of Stonewall and taking the Stonewall story and not just telling about it as an event that happened in the past, but commemorating it in the streets of their own city, remembering it, kind of cultivating the memory of it through the pride rituals that began the year after the Stonewall riots. So the summer of 1970 was the first demonstrations in New York and in Los Angeles, again, prominently involving the Metropolitan Community Church. And it spread onward and outward from there, that the commemoration of Stonewall is one of the reasons why we today know about that event. So that's one way to look at the prominent involvement and the influential involvement of people of faith in that movement, that ironically, as they were commemorating and kind of cultivating the memory of this event, they were also raising the profile, so to speak, of a particular sector of the movement that tended to be, again, Marxist or very critical of religion. Those were the most prominent gay liberation spokespersons. Let me add one more piece to that. There's been a lot of recent controversy over how Stonewall is remembered, and that's been controversy brought up by the recent movie. It's called Stonewall. It's coming out in September. And the critique of that movie, and I think the rightful critique of that movie, is that it eclipses the place of transgender and people of color activists in that moment. And we'll see, actually, when the movie comes out, how those figures are being portrayed. But another piece of you know, if we're looking at what is visible and what is invisible in the way we remember history, one thing that is important to keep in mind is that Stonewall actually had an outsized influence because, to speak maybe kind of tongue-in-cheek, we could almost speak of the Stonewall washing of queer history, meaning that there's a lot of queer history outside of that event, that because that particular event is seen as the birthplace of gay pride, that language obscures from view the previous organizing and the organizing that was taking place outside of that particular event. So what I do in that chapter is actually look back again at Stonewall and notice how religious or spiritual the language is to talk about the Stonewall as a site of birth or even rebirth of gay identity. Those who are familiar with narratives about civil religion in the United States should perk their ears up there and kind of look at how Stonewall itself and the commemoration of Stonewall has carved out a place in the civic calendar for LGBT queer identity, that has been a civic moment, that because of its ritual familiarity, I guess, in a civil religious kind of calendar, has heightened the place of LGBT people as American citizens. So I think there's a lot more to Stonewall than meets the eye, that there's a lot there to look at through the lens of ritual practice and secularization theory than you might see if you just approach it as a simple fact of history.
So given the momentum of the LGBT rights movement in the 1960s and 70s, why has it taken so long for gay marriage to become legal and for denominations to finally accept LGBT persons?
One of the reasons for that, or one of the things to look at there, is what else was going on in the 1970s. The last chapter of my book, if we were to end there, the trajectory looks so hopeful, right? If you kind of stop the clock in 1976, it looks as if gays and lesbians and kind of this larger movement is about to gain all kinds of mainstream visibility. And certainly that was going on and that was happening. But what also was going on at that same time was mobilizing forces of opposition as well. 1966 and 67 were kind of tipping points in anti-gay activism. And that was the case both in national politics. It was that time period that the Save Our Children campaign was successful in Florida in taking out gay rights provisions that had just been instituted in Miami and Dade County. And they went on to take the strategy that they worked out in South Florida and take it to other locations in the United States. So that was happening kind of on the national scene. And then when you look at mainline denominations, it was also in the late 1970s that the handful of local churches and governing bodies were beginning to forward openly gay or lesbian candidates for ordination. And when that hit the larger governing bodies of the church, that also drew out retrenchment and opposition. So kind of what happened at that moment in the late 1970s was the beginning of public battles. And I think those public battles, we know them most because of the anti-gay activism that they stirred up. But even that anti-gay activism, I would say, was kind of paradoxically important for bringing attention to identity organizing around homosexuality to begin with. That there was a part of that conflict that raised the profile of both movements. And it has taken quite a while. So it's only been in the past decade or so that many mainline Protestants have actually begun to allow for candidates to be ordained and for marriage ceremonies of same-sex couples to take place. And that progress has been another tipping point, and that's the demographic tipping point, so that a majority of those denominations are willing to support or at least tolerate those kinds of practices within the church. It's been a kind of uneven road. The hanging question, the question that's left from this, is what to think about those mobilizing forces of oppositions in denominations and in public politics and what's been called the Christian right or the religious right. Where did that come from? Particularly since we think of those forces as traditionalists, that they're mobilizing or they're resurrecting or working to reauthorize older religious traditions. So part of what I do is to think about how the modernism or the inventiveness and even the innovation that it has been taking place in conservative Protestant traditions. And chapter 4, the title is Sanctified Heterosexuality. It looks at a very specific debate taking place in the Presbyterian Church, but that debate was kind of part of a larger conversation around Protestants and conservative Protestants and sexuality. I kind of used that to show how conservative Protestants and particularly evangelicals were beginning to adopt therapeutic ideas about sexuality. One important part of that was the importance of heterosexuality, a particular way of thinking about heterosexuality as healthy, right, natural, and normal. It was not enough to be married. It wasn't enough to have kids. That there was a very specific idea about heterosexuality that kind of mandated attraction between men and women as something that was intrinsic to their natures and also intrinsic to God's design. That actually was a new idea. Sexuality and sexual expression wasn't just for having children, but it was also for pleasure, and that pleasure was good and that God wanted that. And so I kind of trace out how conservative Protestants began to embrace this particular understanding of heterosexuality. And so all of that is a predecessor for understanding the culture wars of the late 1970s and later, that Protestants were mobilized in a way around a kind of identity category, sexuality as an identity category. And we often think of conservative traditions, especially anti-gay traditions, as coming from a very different place than LGBT identities. But both have roots in these therapeutic understandings of sexuality as central to identity, as central to what it is to be human and what it is to, in conservative evangelical terms, express God's design. And both, in a sense, have that modern inventiveness.
All right, last question. What would you like your readers to take away from this book?
The reader that I had in mind was someone who would very easily dismiss religion as intrinsically or essentially homophobic, sexist, anti-modern. And one of the more recent concerns that I think my book plugs into is actually some of the thinking that has come in around secularism, critical secular studies, and how we need to think and look more carefully at religion to understand how it is also historically constructed and changeable over time, and that there are particular ways of understanding religion in the generic abstract sense that can be mapped on human history in a kind of absolute way. That one of the things that my book challenges is that way of thinking about religion. And I think that challenging that understanding of religion is important for all kinds of contemporary politics and social movements. That there's a lot in that idea that goes into contemporary ways of understanding Islam as necessarily conservative and therefore scary and frightening. And there's a lot of ways that even conservative Christianity is kind of painted with that same kind of brush, that religion is somehow backwards, internal, and therefore we can dismiss it as a subject of analysis. In the broadest sense, I really hope that my book contributes to that kind of rethinking and that kind of effort to look carefully and critically, especially at conservative or traditionalist kinds of expressions of religion, and to both take seriously the claims that they have to make about themselves and also to look carefully and critically at how those ideas have emerged over time and are also part of the ongoing inventiveness that humans do so well around so many of the things that we're part of.
With that, we conclude this episode of First Impressions. Again, the book is Reforming Sodom, Protestants and the Rise of Gay Rights. Thanks to Heather White for joining us, and thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. Have a great day.